Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been in Brussels today meeting NATO partners to discuss the situation in Ukraine. Whilst Ukraine isn't a NATO member, most of its military aid and intelligence support for its defence against Russia's invasion is coming from countries signed up to the North Atlantic Treaty Organisation. It's a military pact that was forged between Western allies after World War II, a promise to defend each other should any NATO member come under attack. Well, there may be a certain amount of nervousness at NATO headquarters in Brussels at the moment following the election victory of Donald Trump. The president-elect once said he would encourage Russia to attack any NATO member that failed to meet the alliance's target of spending 2% of GDP on defence. He even threatened to pull America, the biggest, most important member, out of NATO in the past. Now, Mr. Trump didn't repeat that threat during the recent campaign. And today, the outgoing Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, tried to strike a reassuring tone of US commitment to the fight in Ukraine.
The United States continues to step up. We've obligated just recently and pushed out the door another $8 billion in security assistance for Ukraine. That was in September. Another almost $500 million just a few weeks ago. And President Biden is committed to making sure that every dollar we have at our disposal will be pushed out the door between now and January 20th. We're making sure that Ukraine has the air defenses it needs, that it has the artillery it needs, that it has the armored vehicles it needs.
Well, in a moment, we'll be hearing from the president of Latvia, one NATO member that exceeds the minimum 2% defence spending by some margin. But first to Ukraine, where there's been an unprecedented surge in Russian drone and missile strikes in recent weeks. In October, a record 2,000 were reportedly fired, with 145 this past Sunday alone, the most in a single day since Moscow's full-scale invasion. In Ukraine's Kyiv region, defence units are being stretched to the limit, as our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse reports.
They're a constant presence, but at the moment the sirens of Kyiv and cities across Ukraine, they're not stopping. They go off at any point, every day. Sometimes they are followed by the booms of the city's air defences and explosions, and sometimes they're not. And somewhere, someone feels their full impact.
So your room and your bed.
In Kyiv, Victoria and Volodymyr show us what's left of their high-rise flat.
We heard the sirens, and almost immediately after, there was an explosion.
Their 14-year-old daughter, Maria, had come home early and was lying in her bed.
A Shahed drone flew in through the window, right into her room. She had no chance to survive. She died immediately.
My goodness. And it's immediate. You walk through the front door and their flat is completely gutted. And we are looking through a huge hole in the wall at the skyline of Kyiv. Everything is completely exposed. And this really connects it. You see these drones, you hear the sirens, but this is what they caused.
Everything burned down. There's nothing even left in the memory of my child. Our life is divided into before and after.
You can see the television bracket has bent from the heat. You can see your wine, scorched set of headphones. It's really heartbreaking to see, because you can sort of see the moment and what's been taken. It's very difficult.
Maria didn't want to leave the country. She had faith in victory. So we're all here, but sadly, she is not anymore.
As Ukraine waits to see how Donald Trump will approach this war when he re-enters office, North Korea has joined Moscow's invasion. And Maria's father, Volodymyr, is just baffled as to how it all started.
What's the point of it? There are no benefits. People just get killed. Unfortunately, the end of this doesn't depend too much on Ukraine, I think. It depends on other countries that help us.
Of course, Russia's general aim is to terrorize civilians.
Mikhailo Shamanov is from Kyiv's military administration.
Every night it's a lottery. Where it hits, where it's shot down, where it falls, and what happens. We understand that people are exhausted, but we cannot give up because Kyiv or other cities are being bombarded.
And it's mobile air defense units like this one which keep those drones out, or try to.
This is machine gun.
We are south of Kyiv in the expansive countryside next to the forest, where we meet Vitaly. For him, it has been a busy time.
Half a year ago, it was roughly 50 drones in a month. Now, it's up to 100 drones a night.
And how able are you to stop them? Just how difficult a task is it?
The more missile danger there is, and the more targets we have, the more our guys' spirits are lifted. They're ready to stand to the last hour, or the last shahed. The Russians will never break us by the amount of drones they send.
And sure enough, our conversation is interrupted by the echo of the air raid siren. Across the tree lines there, these guys are clearly defiant. They are motivated to defend cities like Kyiv, but they're also keen to express optimism, despite all of the political tides surrounding Ukraine at the moment. And that's not easy with the pressure this country is under.
The BBC's James Waterhouse reporting on the situation in Ukraine there, which is focusing minds at that NATO meeting in Brussels today. Well, earlier I spoke to the president of Latvia, Edgars Rinkevich. His country meets and exceeds the NATO requisite defence spending, as does Estonia, Greece and Poland at over 4%. But what about NATO countries like Spain spending just over 1%, Portugal, Italy and Canada all under 2%? Is Mr Trump right? Do they need to spend more?
Latvia is spending currently 3.4% of GDP, and I think that you understand for very good reason. We have Russia and Belarus both neighboring Latvia. We understand all the risks that those two countries present to Europe and the world. From that point of view, let me say that I do hope that also other European allies, and not only European allies, all NATO allies do understand that spending on defense is not only because the U.S. demand that, but because the current security situation is very dangerous.
So Mr. Trump has said or pledged during his campaign that he would end the war in Ukraine within 24 hours. He hasn't detailed how he plans to do that. What do you think he means by that?
I think that let's wait till the inauguration day. Let's wait till all the key players in his administration are going to be appointed, and let's see what is in this plan. But our position on this issue is that it is of paramount importance to have at least two or three principles. The number one principle, we should not talk about peace in Ukraine without Ukraine being present. Number two, it is important to understand that most probably for Russia this is going to be just a pause in its aggressive war.
Just a pause?
Just a pause. Mm. It's going to use this time to regroup, to retrain its military. And number three, yes, it is very important that there are very strong security guarantees for Ukraine. I think that everyone wants to have peace as soon as possible. But the problem is that in that case, we need sustainable and long-lasting peace, and not in contradiction to international law as well.
Well, so many fear that this plan could involve concessions to Vladimir Putin, basically giving up land, Ukrainian land, to Russia. But I just wanted to ask you, I mean, there are reports that Mr. Trump has had telephone conversations with Vladimir Putin during the campaign and also more recently. It's unclear whether or not this happened, but it does seem as if they could be talking. Now, some say they're worried about that, that it's not documented, but could that be helpful if Mr. Trump is actually does have a working relationship with Vladimir Putin?
Well, I think that we all have seen that when the war started, there were many European leaders making phone calls to Mr. Putin. So I think that talking is not something that one should or can object, because at the end of the day, you want to pass the message about what you think is right. You want to understand what would be the next possible diplomatic moves. I think that when we had peace summit in Switzerland in June, President Zelensky said that he is ready to negotiate with Russia. I think that one thing that is very important is that Ukraine has its legitimate interests taken into account. The real process can start only when there is a change of the administration.
Of course, NATO was forged after World War II, wasn't it, as an alliance. And since then, the United States has undoubtedly been the biggest spender on military for NATO countries. And much of Europe has sort of looked towards America for its security. Is it time that Europe became more militarily independent, do you think, given what's happening in Ukraine? And I just wonder, you know, Mr. Tusk, the Polish Prime Minister, has been sort of saying that in recent days, that Europe must grow up, he said, and believe in its own strength. Should Europe be remilitarizing almost?
Yes, Europe must wake up. Yes, Europe needs to have more self-confidence when it comes to defense and security. But in order to get that self-confidence, to get an equal footing with the United States within NATO, yes, Europe must spend much more. And yes, unfortunately, I do believe that it is time for Europe to go back to those decades when Europe was spending a lot, when Europe's military might was, let's say, more impressive than it's today. And yes, this is time for us also to understand that we are going to be interesting for the United States only if we are strong.
And that was Edgars Rinkevich, there, president of Latvia, speaking to us earlier today. Coming up later this hour, why did this year's Booker Prize winner decide to write a novel set on the International Space Station?
There's something about that short distance of low Earth orbit where the Earth is close. You know, it's only 250 miles away, but it's far enough away for us to get a radically different perspective on it. That's what sort of interests me.
Samantha Harvey speaks to us later this hour. Other headlines, Donald Trump has returned to Washington for the first time since his election victory. He'll be meeting President Biden at the White House to discuss the transition of power. And India's Supreme Court has ruled against the practice of bulldozing the homes of criminal suspects, which rights groups say tends to target Muslims. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, if you've been on social media today, you'll know all the chatter is about the job tech multi-billionaire Elon Musk has just been assigned in the incoming Trump administration. He'll be leading the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, which incidentally is the same name as his favourite cryptocurrency. He says he wants to slash the number of government departments and drive major structural change. Here he is on stage at Donald Trump's Madison Square Gardens rally just before the election, speaking to Howard Lutnick, who heads the Trump transition team.
How much do you think we can rip out of this wasted $6.5 trillion Harris-Biden budget?
Well, I think we can do at least $2 trillion.
Yeah!
Yes.
$2 trillion.
your money is being wasted, and the Department of Government Efficiency is going to fix that.
Well, despite the name of the Department of Government Efficiency, it's not going to be a government agency. It's going to work from outside government in an advisory capacity, we're told. It's also a job share with the former Republican candidate Vivek Ramaswamy. So what might be some of the challenges with such major change of government agencies? Let's speak to Andy Rudelovich, who's Professor of Government at Bowdoin College in Maine. He joins us live. Professor, thanks for coming on. So let's look at the maths. Apparently, the overall budget for the US is about $7 trillion. Mr. Musk says he thinks he can save $2 trillion. Is that possible, and what would he need to cut to make it possible?
Well, thanks for having me. The short answer is no. It's too large an amount to cut, certainly in one fiscal year. You know, of the $7 trillion that you mentioned, $5 trillion of that is tied up in Social Security and healthcare, including Medicare for elderly people, national defense, interest on the national debt. So that leaves $2 trillion, but that includes the entirety of the rest of government. So in order to cut $2 trillion, Mr. Musk would have to wipe out most of governmental functions.
Right. Okay. Well, that sounds quite serious. But he says there are well over 400 agencies and departments. He wants to get that number down to 99. He's got a point, hasn't he? I mean, I've been looking at some of them. We've got the Agricultural Marketing Service. There's an agency for global media. Don't know what that does. And a Bureau for Engraving and Printing. Is that really necessary?
Well, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing does, in fact, print our money. So if we have cash still, I think we will need to keep something like that. Maybe we're going to just move to Dogecoin. That seems to be Mr. Musk's favorite currency, as you mentioned. But yeah, certainly there is room for administrative improvement in government. There are agencies probably that could be eliminated. But we're talking about pennies on the dollar. These are going to cut very small amounts of the very large federal budget. If we want to cut real money, we have to cut real programs.
Okay. You are a professor of government, and I just wonder what you make of this idea of having this Department of Government Efficiency operating outside the government. I don't know why they're doing that and what some of the concerns might be about that.
Well, there's organizational concerns in terms of what kind of leverage they will have. As you say, they're not a department. It'll be some sort of White House advisory group or outside commission. There are rules regarding transparency of those kinds of committees. And I think the funding issues are also fairly real, right? You need to have some kind of funding for the personnel involved. Other concerns, though, are more in terms of conflicts of interest, right? When President Reagan had a similar exercise back in the 1980s under businessman Peter Grace, the so-called Grace Commission, you know, they had thousands of government executives wandering around the federal bureaucracy looking for things to change. And of course, some of those agencies were regulating those same executives. So there are real potential for conflict of interest here, especially since Mr. Musk has so much money tied up in government contracts.
Okay, well, we must leave it there, but many thanks for joining us live from Maine, Professor Andy Rudelovich there. Now, a lot of the discussion ahead of the US election was about migration, of course, and a recent American migrant to the UK has been causing quite a storm in recent days. It's a tiny little bird that somehow flew off course somewhere in southern USA and wound up in Yorkshire, northern England. That's the lovely sound of a scarlet tanager. Bird watchers have been flocking to a little street in Halifax where it was last seen. John Carter is from the British Trust for Ornithology. It's called a scarlet tanager, but this bird is yellow. Why is that?
The adult males in the breeding season are this lovely scarlet red colour, which lends them their name, and they've got black wings and a black tail. But when they finish breeding, the adult males molt and they become this kind of yellowy greeny colour with dark wings. And the females always look like that, and the juveniles look like that too. So it's only when the males are in their breeding finery in the spring and summer that they look that fabulous with a bright red.
And we are convinced that this is a scarlet tanager, not just an ordinary gold finch or yellow hammer that might be seen locally around
there. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're quite distinctive. There are three species which breed really quite commonly in bits of North America, and there are many, many, many of them in Central and South America too. And so we are familiar enough with the kind of species of birds, the families of birds, to be able to know when this arrived, it was clearly something different. And then we whittled it down, or somebody whittled it down to the fact that it was clearly a tanager, and then it was down to species. It was fairly relatively easy to do.
So how did it get here? Because it's thousands of miles off course.
I mean, we do get quite a few American vagrant birds in the UK, and this is often connected to weather. You know, so if we get these big kind of storms that rage across the Atlantic from the US or from Canada or from further south across the Atlantic, they can bring these birds that are migrating south, and they get caught in this weather and they get drift across east, and then they hit remote islands very often, such as the Scilly Isles or Western Scotland or Shetland. And then maybe they kind of reorientate and they kind of start moving and migrating in a normal way. They kind of think, OK, I still need to go south. So they start moving again. But these things are vagrants. They're lost. So they do turn up in odd places. And when they do arrive, they often stand out.
But, I mean, can it survive in Yorkshire, which does get quite frosty? Fairly soon it's going to start getting cold there.
Yeah, I mean, these are principally insect eaters during the summer, and then they kind of start eating bits of fruit in the winter as well. So in their native range, they would now be, you know, heading down into Central and South America. The likelihood of it surviving in Yorkshire is pretty slim. But if it kind of gets itself down to Spain or North Africa or somewhere like that, it may survive the winter fine.
Well, now, twitchers, as we call bird watchers in the UK, have been going crazy about this. Lots have been driving through the night with their binoculars, turning up in this little cul-de-sac in Halifax, Yorkshire, trying to get a glimpse of it. Just tell us why people are so obsessed with things like this.
People who are into birds, you know, they get very obsessed with birds. I mean, as with any other hobby, I suppose. And twitchers are a very specific type of bird watcher. Not all bird watchers are twitchers. Twitchers are those ones who charge around and do want to kind of see new birds and add them to their list. When they hear of a new bird, they haven't got it on their list, they've never seen one before, and they want to be part of that club. Yeah, they do make these huge journeys. I mean, I was talking to somebody yesterday who was there, and they'd been there 6 hours, and they hadn't seen it. And this is one of the perils of being a twitcher. So you kind of throw your lot in, and you really risk everything to see the thing, and sometimes you don't.
It's a very pretty little bird, but it also has a lovely voice, which we heard just before we spoke to you. Is it true that birds have regional accents when they sing?
There's been quite a bit of work around this, and some certainly do. Some have been proven to have regional accents. I mean, I don't think this one will pick up a Yorkshire accent anytime soon. But they do, yeah, they will. They will vary the way that they sing, depending on where they come from.
John Carter there from the British Trust for Ornithology. Welcome back to NewsHour. World leaders, delegates, hosts of other people are currently attending the COP29 climate summit in Azerbaijan. And there's lots of conversations going on about how to mitigate and adapt to our warming planet. So what are some of the solutions? Here in the UK, the world famous Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew have been looking at agricultural crops and how they might be adapted to survive climate change in the future. The organisation's Dr. Caspar Chater told me more.
We are particularly interested and focused on biodiversity, and agri-biodiversity is also a critical part of that. So what I mean by agri-biodiversity is the biodiversity that we have in our crops, in the foods we grow and eat. Really, what our work shows is that if we are able to diversify the foods we grow and diversify the foods we have on our plate, then we have a more robust, more resilient food system that's less prone to famines and the problems of putting all your eggs in one basket that we've been doing for so long.
So that sounds sensible, diversifying in terms of what we grow and what we eat. But also, I think you've been developing resistant strains as well of vegetables and crops that we can grow, things that might be more likely to survive floods or that need less water that can survive in a drought.
Yes, that's right. So many people over many years have been getting hold of really priceless germplasm, and I mean by that seeds from around the world from different species of plants, and storing them in local seed banks or in partnership with the Millennium Seed Bank. So if we have access to that diversity, we can then draw on that diversity and find the traits that are really key to improving those crops. And my work in particular focuses on drought resilience and heat stress tolerance. And so I'm working on beans, different species of bean, to resist those major changes that are coming in our, already here in our climates.
Given your area of research, do you think that perhaps we need to reimagine our whole approach to farming that we've been so used to for sort of hundreds of years? Do we need to look at that in various parts of the world?
Most definitely. And I think that the last few decades have really shown the consequences of relying on one farming model, and that is monoculture. So that is growing one species in one very large field system and growing that alone. So there are a handful of crops that we eat every day. Rice, for example, wheat, corn. And those are key to our calorie needs globally. But the problem is that if we rely on those solely, then we're missing the great diversity that will help us buffer against the extremes of climate change.
Dr. Caspar Chater there from Kew Gardens here in London. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Last month, the US State Department issued an ultimatum to Israel that they had 30 days to improve conditions in Gaza or risk a reduction in American military aid. Well, those 30 days are up and many of the detailed demands in the letter have not been met. On Tuesday night, NewsHour's Tim Frank spoke to Shimon Friedman, who's international spokesman for COGAT. That's the branch of the Israeli military responsible for coordinating aid deliveries into Gaza.
Israel has worked since the beginning of the war, and COGAT specifically has worked to facilitate the entry of humanitarian aid, to increase the access to medical care, to bring in food, water, medical supplies, and shelter equipment. And we work together with the international organizations to facilitate the entry of this aid.
That doesn't really tally with reality, though, does it? Because, I mean, before the war started, 500 trucks were going in per day. The US has said a minimum of 350 is needed right now. It's a matter of a few dozen at most that are going in. So, I mean, it's all very well to say that you're sort of facilitating and you're doing all that you can, but you've got senior UN officials saying that it is not a place for humans to survive.
It's close to around 50 trucks in northern Gaza a day and between 100 and 150 trucks in southern Gaza. Those numbers, we're working to increase them. The issue right now, the main obstacle in getting much larger numbers of aid into the Gaza Strip are with the international organizations, because if we were to bring in additional, those would just be, not that there's room right now on the Gazan side of Kerem Shalom, because there are so many trucks waiting there.
Kerem Shalom is just one of the many crossing points there could be into Gaza. That is part of the problem, is that you have decided that you are going to only allow very limited access points. And you have also decided that inside Gaza, absolutely, it is a war, but it is a war zone in which the Israelis are not doing all that they could in order to facilitate the humanitarian organizations to get to these places.
You're right. Kerem Shalom is only one crossing. There are five crossings right now. There is Kerem Shalom. There is Kisufim, which opened today, crossing 96, Erez West and Erez East. These crossings are operational, and we are delivering we are facilitating the entry of humanitarian aid through all of them. So the reason I keep bringing up Kerem Shalom is because that is the crossing that has the largest capacity. But we are absolutely using the other crossings as well. And we've gone to great lengths in order to increase our capacity there.
Shimon Friedman from COGAT speaking to Tim Franks. Well, last night, the UN's Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights, Ilse Brands-Karis, warned that Gaza was on the brink of famine due to Israeli actions violating international humanitarian law. She was addressing the UN Security Council.
There is a strong likelihood that famine is imminent. This horrific possibility cannot be separated from the unrelenting attacks on the human rights of civilians there. Over the past 5 weeks, the Israeli military has conducted strikes that have led to massive civilian fatalities in northern Gaza, particularly impacting women, children, older people, the sick, and people with disabilities, many of whom are reportedly trapped by Israeli military restrictions and attacks on escape routes.
Well, despite all that, the US has said that it will continue to provide military aid. So what do aid agencies think about all this? I've been speaking to Jeremy Konijndijk, who's president of the Refugees International Group, which provides aid to Gaza.
About a month ago, the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense from the United States wrote to the Israeli Minister of Defense outlining a very concrete, very specific set of demands for facilitating humanitarian aid and humanitarian protection inside of Gaza. And this is really important because it's the first time in public that the U.S. government has articulated such an explicit set of conditions for basically judging whether the Israeli government is meeting the most minimal thresholds for sincerely trying to facilitate humanitarian action. What we found was across about 19 individual specific demands that we were able to assess in this paper, there was not a single one that the Israeli government had fully complied on, and only four where we saw even some indication of partial progress.
So, I mean, you know the Israeli government view on this. They blame the United Nations and other aid organizations, saying that the problem is on their end, that they haven't coordinated the aid properly to get it through.
That is their claim. And I think, again, that's where this letter from the U.S. secretaries is so important and so helpful, because it kind of takes it out of that debate. And it just puts a very specific set of things that the Israeli government needs to do. It's not to say there's nothing the UN or the NGOs need to do. But the reality on the ground is that the Israeli government has immense operational control over anything and everything that humanitarian groups are able to do inside Gaza. So one example of that from the letter is approving drivers for trucks. So the UN cannot simply scale up its logistical capabilities inside Gaza. They need Israeli permission for bringing in trucks. They need Israeli government permission for which drivers are allowed to drive those trucks. And one of the statistics that we identify in the report is that of the 400 drivers that the letter demanded the Israeli government approve, virtually none were approved. The World Food Program sought more than 300 drivers to be approved by the Israeli government, and so far only about 30 have been. So, it is that sort of posture by the Israeli government that simultaneously kind of hampers the UN from being able to operate, while the Israeli government simultaneously blames it for its inability to scale up.
So have you noticed any improvement in the conditions in Gaza over the past 30 days? And what do you make of the American government just sort of waving through this deadline it set?
There has been no improvement. In fact, there's been significant deterioration, particularly in northern Gaza. Another of the conditions in the letter was calling on the Israeli government to make clear they were not going to pursue this plan to empty northern Gaza and to use aid deprivation as a tool to do that. And of course, that's exactly what we've seen happening over the last month. As to why the Biden administration ultimately kind of rolled over on its own set of demands, I think that is what we have seen from them throughout the war. There has been this pattern of demanding and pleading and requesting. Time and again, they are ignored and ignored, or maybe there's a small symbolic concession.
What should the Biden administration have done?
You know, at the most basic level, simply follow and adhere to U.S. law. So there is something called Section 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act that requires that if a country is blocking U.S. humanitarian assistance from being delivered, they are not eligible to receive U.S. security assistance, i.e. arms transfers. It is very clear from our report and from others that the Israeli government is violating that. The letter from the Secretaries of Defense and State sets out very clear conditions for judging that. So what the Biden administration should do is follow the law. And that would mean, in this case, halting and conditioning arms transfers until we see this situation dramatically turn around.
Jeremy Konyndyk there from Refugees International. Now to an intriguing story of espionage, a Russian spy that went rogue and turned himself into a foreign state. 5 years ago, a group of fishermen off the coast of Norway were stunned when a white beluga whale approached their boat in a friendly manner. The whale was wearing a harness, prompting speculation that it was a Russian spy whale that had escaped. Well, new evidence has just emerged to support that theory. The BBC's Jonah Fisher picks up the story.
It's April 2019 and a beluga whale has surfaced alongside Jor Heston's fishing boat in the far north of Norway.
We saw a white shadow in the water. This white shadow was big and moving towards us. It turned out to be a beluga whale. It was really strange. This region is not natural habitat for beluga whales. I've never seen one in these waters. As it came closer, we saw that it was entangled with something. First, we thought it was a rope or some fishing gear.
In fact, it was a harness, and once Jaw had jumped in the water and freed the whale, attention was drawn to the words written on the harness buckle.
No, there was no cameras on it or anything. It was just like this.
Jürgen Rewig is from the Norwegian Directorate of Fisheries.
And it also says on the small letters on the clips.
Equipment, St. Petersburg.
Alan Klo was the first journalist on the scene.
How is this possible? We didn't have any answers. This was supposed to be a fun and warm story about a mammal being freed. But it really dawned on me that this is something far bigger than I've been doing before.
Freed from the harness, the beluga, instead of swimming off, sought out more human contact and took up residence at the harbour of Hammerfest. The whale was given the name Valdemir, a blend of the Norwegian word for whale and the first name of President Putin.
People in Hammerfest was quite proud that the white whale came to them. And then we saw even more advanced tricks.
I could see that people were using GoPros and hope to get underwater footage of the whale.
Eve Jourdain is a whale researcher at the Norwegian Orca Survey.
It was very obvious that this particular whale had been conditioned to be putting his nose on anything that looked like a target because he was doing it each time. But we have no idea what kind of facility he was in, so we don't know what he was trained for.
The marine mystery made headlines around the world.
Beluga whale found off the coast of Norway.
A beluga whale wearing a harness.
But it was widely thought at the time that the beluga was most likely a spy whale trained by Russia. But that's just been an assumption until now.
I'm 99% sure that he escaped.
This is Dr. Olga Spak. She's just told a new BBC documentary that she believes the whale fled Russian military training.
I can't fully disclose the contacts where I got this information from. I've heard what his nickname was. His nickname was Andriuha. This animal was kind of easy to train. It was inquisitive and active, but at the same time, it had the character that it often did what he wanted to do. It seemed like no one was surprised that it actually just escaped.
But what are the whales being trained to do? Satellite images suggest they're being kept in pens alongside a Russian submarine base near Murmansk.
Here,
we can see Russian nuclear-powered submarines.
Thomas Nielsen is the editor of Norwegian online newspaper, the Barents Observer.
The location of the beluga whales, very close to the submarines and the surface vessels, might tell us that they were actually part of a guarding system. They could be considered a kind of underwater guard dogs.
Sadly, there is no happy ending. 2 months ago, the beluga's lifeless body was found floating off the coast of Norway. So had Putin's Russia caught up with the whale that got away? In this case, it appears the answer is no. The Norwegian authorities say Faldemir, or should that be Andruha, died when a stick became lodged in his mouth.
Jonah Fisher on the Russian spy whale Defector. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Last night, Samantha Harvey won this year's prestigious Booker Prize for fiction for her book Orbital. It's set during a 24-hour period on the International Space Station, and it's a short, I'm told, rather beautiful book which explores the relationship that human beings have not just with space but with planet Earth. Early this morning, she came into the NewsHour studio, and I asked her how she succeeded in describing so vividly space, a place that she's never been to.
I mean, in a sense, this is kind of the, you know, the novelist stock in trade. This is what we do. We just imagine ourselves to places. So people are now living in space. We have, as a species, been living there for a quarter of a century. And I really wanted to do justice to their experience and to try to get it right. So there's so much information about the ISS online.
The International Space Station.
The International Space Station.
Yeah.
And the spacecraft in my novel is sort of an international space station, which is clearly very closely mapped to the International Space Station. Mm. But I wanted to give myself that slight latitude. It didn't have to be exactly the same.
And just briefly, that you did sort of write most of it during lockdown, didn't you? When everyone was so constrained as to what they could do, and yet you're, you know, writing about this vast universe and, you know, infinity and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, in a sense, yeah, sort of half of what you're doing is writing about the kind of agoraphobic expanse of space and the fact that the four astronauts and two cosmonauts in my novel are detached from the rest of humanity, but they are also in a very confined space. So I found myself writing quite a lot of it in lockdown, and it was a very, very apposite book to be writing then, because I was on one hand writing about confinement and six people who can't reach back to their loved ones. Mm. In the book, one of the astronauts' mother dies, and she obviously can't get back to the funeral. So there was something that seemed quite kind of true to human experience, you know, our lived experience at that time.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you know, every day I was able to undertake this incredible, beautiful journey of escapism, you know.
To get away from lockdown.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it made my lockdown feel a lot more expansive than it might otherwise.
You mentioned the characters in the book, and for our programme it's fascinating because they're drawn from all over the world. You've got an Italian, someone from Japan, America, Russia. Was that also the kind of international element that you were hoping to get, you know, in terms of world citizens as they're peering out of the space station looking back to Earth?
Yeah, I wanted the makeup of the crew to be somewhat credible so that it could be potentially a crew that would exist on the ISS. I think something that really draws me to the ISS as a project is the fact of its internationalism and its symbol of, not just a symbol, but it's an incredible symbol of cooperation between nations.
Mm.
And it was a sort of response to the end of the Cold War and some effort at a new dawn, a new way of Russia and the West working together.
Mm.
It has 17, I think, contributing nations. And I love that about it. And I think that there's something quite poignant about the fact that the ISS will be deorbited in a few years. And of course, relations now between Russia and the West have completely collapsed. And there's something there that I wanted to point at, sort of this, you know, like a nostalgic saying goodbye to this amazing spacecraft that has been born of peace and peaceful cooperation. Mm. And we're now in an era, I fear, that is beyond that.
And the focus, as I mentioned, is the Earth, isn't it? They're sort of looking back, they're communicating back with the Earth, they're viewing it from a view that, well, you've never had, even though you're writing about it, most of us never have. And what was your message with that?
Well, I don't know if I had a message as such, but I try to write from some kind of emotional centre in myself, I suppose. I'm not a great planner when it comes to writing, but I do have a strong sense of what I want the book to feel like, what I want its sentiment to be, I guess. And with this book, from the outset, I knew that I wanted its sentiment to be one of wonder or joy, rapture, all of those things. I wanted it to feel ultimately open and breathless and sort of alive and expansive.
The book is called Orbital, obviously, as we mentioned, but it takes place in the course of one day, which I guess is one circle around the Earth. Have I got that? No, there's several, I think.
Yes, right? Yes, so it's one day, so it's 24 hours, but it's 16 transits, full transits around the Earth. Mm. So in that one 24-hour period, the astronauts, in fact, have 16 days and 16 nights. The book wasn't originally set over one day. It was over a longer period, and I was really struggling with how to articulate the bizarreness, as I imagined it, the bizarreness of time being exploded in this way while you're in orbit. And it was only when I understood that I could set it over one day and sort of encode that strangeness into the structure of the book.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, of course, that's how it should be. You know? And once I decided on that, it really came together quite quickly and it aligned. It's complicated because I had a set of 16 orbits mapped out, and I had to follow them really closely. So if I wanted in one section to, you know, talk about what was happening with a typhoon that's hitting the Philippines in the day in the novel, but they weren't over the Philippines at that time, they were in fact over Western Europe, then that was just as it was. I couldn't change that. Yeah. I wanted to be true to the actual orbits of that day. So my view was always confined to where they would be at that point over the Earth. So I had sort of complicated maps and diagrams.
It sounds fascinating. And you must have learned so much about space in the course of writing this book. Have you always been interested in space? And would you fancy going there yourself?
Well, I've always been interested in space, but in quite a limited way. I am interested in space insofar as it affords us a perspective to look back at ourselves. I think there's something about that short distance of low Earth orbit where the Earth is close. You know, it's only 250 miles away, but it's far enough away for us to get a radically different perspective on it. That's what sort of interests me. Mm. Would I go there? I want to say yes, but in reality, I think probably no.
Stay on Earth.
Yes. I think it's... I've probably been as close to space in this book as I'm going to get.
And that was Samantha Harvey, the author of Orbital and the winner of this year's Booker Prize, speaking to us here on NewsHour.